This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today as host for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and we really appreciate you tuning in to Trumpet Hour today to learn all about the big news stories of the week and why they matter. For our panel today, here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Anthony Chibadidwe.
Greetings, everyone.
Joining us via Skype from our office in the UK is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And joining us via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, Israel, Brent Noctical.
Hello.
Well, on Tuesday, some leadership from factions in Iraq decided to work together to try to pass a resolution in the Iraqi parliament to remove U.S. troops from the country. To tell us about what this would mean for the U.S., for Iraq, and for the Middle East, we'll go to our Jerusalem Bureau and Brent Noctical.
Yeah, this is really interesting because it came about because of an interview that Mr. Donald Trump had, the U.S. president had, with CBS this week. He talked about the importance of the United States forces in Iraq. He talked about how he visited that base and how impressed he was with that base, the massive airstrip that was there. Currently, there's about 5,000 U.S. troops operating out of Iraq, and their mission is to fight against the Islamic State. That's their main mission. But while he was giving this CBS interview, he talked about how that U.S. forces are currently using this base to keep a close eye on Iran because Iran is a real problem, he said. And so a lot of Iraqis are looking at this and saying, well, according to our constitution, you can't be using our state or here by invitation to fight against the Islamic State and then have another aim to keep an eye on Iran's activities. Now, this is important because it comes into the backdrop of the United States pullout of Syria. And a lot of people jumped on the back of Mr. Trump for doing this. We're very upset on Mr. Trump for doing this because it's the Syrian force, the United States force in Syria was great because it was not only there as a counter against the Islamic State, but a counter against Iran. And so President Trump came out and said, in response to all those people saying, don't worry, everybody, we can still keep an eye on Iran, but we're just going to do that from Iraq now. And so now the Iraqis are like, hey, what are you doing using our nation to further your own wars against another nation state in Iran, in such as Iran? And so they are upset by this. We had the president, we had the prime minister, each came out and gave statements about this, how they disagreed with this, how the United States can't use its base in Iraq to fight against Iran or to launch an attack against Iran. And so now it looks like it's going to come to vote in the Iraqi parliament to remove the U.S. forces from this base, which means that even though the U.S. President Trump said he wants to keep this base open, the U.S. forces might be forced out.
So are there any fears among the Iraqi leaders that, if the U.S. exits, their country would be entirely overrun by the mullah's regime in Iran? Or at this point, would they welcome that?
I don't think they would welcome that. I think the Iraqis in general are trying to navigate the very tight rope of US on one side, Iran on the other. I really do think they are trying to do that. But it is becoming more increasingly difficult to do that considering the trade relationship they have with Iran right next door. Considering the fact that the United States has basically said that though they might want to keep this base open in Iraq, that could change on a dime. And if they put all their eggs in the United States basket right now or support or basically going all in with the United States, they could be left high and dry when the United States decides by a flip of a hat that they want to get out of the country. That said, we do see the Iraqi parliament more pro-Iran right now than it has ever been, while the prime minister itself might try and maintain some type of even-handed relationship, well, even it out between the U.S. influence and Iranian influence, the parliament itself is very pro-Iran. And so that's why this could actually pass through the parliament. The prime minister would have his hands tied. He might want the U.S. forces there, but because there's so many pro-Iran factions, and they're really just proxies of Iran, inside parliamentary groups, inside the Iraqi parliament, they could get this done no matter what the prime minister says.
So a little later in the show, we'll talk about President Trump's State of the Union address that was delivered this week. And in one pretty notable part of that, he said, "Great nations do not fight endless wars." And I think that is the feeling that many Americans have about America's ongoing presence in Iraq and in so many other places in the Middle East. What would you say about this potential ousting of U.S. troops from Iraq in that context?
Well, I think that's, I mean, yes, you could say, why don't we just all bring the troops home? But when you just consider, I would just say from a purely strategic standpoint, when you consider this, the few number of troops that are there, 5,000, it's not much, not that expensive to have them there. And it is an extremely large counter against Iranian influence in Iraq. It is. And so we look at it from the perspective of biblical prophecy. And so regardless if we think it's going to be good for the United States to be there or not be there, Bible prophecy says that Iran is going to gain full control over Iraqi politics. They are going to gain a full control over the state itself. It is going to command the control of their land, just like we have seen take place. I mean, this is a prophecy that we've talked about for about 20 years. We've said that Iraq is going to fall to Iran. That was repeated in a major way by the trumpet when the United States forces went in to remove Saddam Hussein, who was the largest counter to Iranian takeover of Iraq. And so this has been going on for decades now, just inch by inch, Iran's power increasing over Iraq. And the Bible says that's going to happen. And so when we see the Iraqi parliament itself looking towards the time that the U.S. forces are not going to be there, this would be the first time since 2003 they're not going to be there. This is something that shows how close biblical prophecies are this prophecy is for being fully fulfilled. And that prophecy that refers to the king of the south in Iraq being part of the king of the south is found over in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40. And if people want to read more about this, they can read an article that our editor-in-chief wrote about Iraq and the fall of the Islamic State and Iran's influence. It is entitled America's Greatest Defeat, Iran's Victory, and it was written last year.
Okay, and we'll be sure to include a link to that in the show notes. If any listeners would just go to thetrumpet.com, click on the Listen tab, and then you'll find the Trumpet Hour there. And the most recent episode will have links to all the stories that we're discussing today and to literature that is connected to the biblical prophecies that are related to these stories. Thanks very much for that, Brent. The United States has announced that it is suspending compliance with the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or the INF Treaty, with Russia, which bans both countries from developing or using moderate-range nuclear missiles. And Russia said that it, too, would abandon this landmark agreement. So this is a major development for the U.S. and for Russia, but the real nations to watch in this context are actually those of Europe. For this, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, like you said, there's a whole lot of reasons to watch this news story. But what I want to focus on today is the effect on Europe, because really this whole treaty revolves around Europe. And to go through some of the history, which you covered in an article that we had up on the website during the week, you go back to the 70s and Russia developed this this nuclear missile that would launch from a mobile base and it would travel fast. It would be able to hit a European country, you know, a NATO target within Europe within about 10 minutes. So you've got a weapon that made European nations and America very, very nervous, because it meant that Russia could launch a missile and, you know, if you detected it before it hit, you would have to respond pretty much right away. There would be no time to sit around to ask questions, to get a second opinion. Is this really a nuclear strike, or is it a mistake on my computer screen? You've got to respond fast. And the fear was that this could lead to Russia launching a nuclear first strike, a nuclear surprise attack. So Europe NATO weren't happy about this, and they eventually got Russia to back down and got both sides to get rid of these missiles. And the way they did it is the United States made a short-range missile of its own, stationed it in Europe and in Turkey, and then, you know, boom, they had the same capability. They could wipe out Moscow and St. Petersburg within a few minutes with a hard-to-detect missile. Both sides weren't happy, and so both sides climbed down. They both agreed to destroy their weapon systems. Now you've got this same kind of arms race breaking out again, but with an important difference. So with America pulled out of this INF treaty because Russia has been developing missiles that seem very like they violate this treaty. Russia, according to their figures that they publish, say that they just fall just short of the range covered by this treaty. I don't think anyone really believes that. They are these same type of missiles, just more advanced, better able to fly low and avoid radar. And once again, European cities are in the crosshairs of a nuclear surprise attack. And the big question is, okay, as these weapons roll out, now that there's no limitation whatsoever with this INF treaty being, Russia was breaking it anyway, but they don't even have to pretend to agree with it now. What's Europe going to do? The old solution, what they went with in the 80s, you know, they know that it's going to take force to make Russia back down. The old solution was that America came in with its short-range nuclear missiles and forced Russia to back down. Today, where Europe is increasingly wanting to push its own way to stay separate from the United States, to follow its own path, they're not going to be so happy with that. And so already within a week of this INF treaty, you're seeing more and more people in Europe talking about, well, maybe we need to get much more serious about our nuclear defense. And even within Germany, say, starting a discussion about nuclear weapons, NATO nuclear weapons, nuclear weapons, and what they need to do. I'll just, the Spiegel Online, they had an excellent article where they went through some of these discussions and some of these quotes that are from European leaders. Roderick Kesselwesser, for example, who's a defense expert for the Christian Democratic Party in Germany, he said that if Russia doesn't dismantle its systems, we must ensure Europe's security and shouldn't exclude any options, even nuclear ones. Elmar Brok, another CDU member, he's a member of the European Parliament. He said that if Putin continues to go down this path, one must, if need be, consider nuclear retrofitting Europe. So you've got German leaders talking about nuclear weapons. There was another German leader who talked about, well, at the moment, Poland and much of Eastern Europe, they look to America for their protection. If we're going to respond to this, we need to stop that. And we need to get them looking to Germany for protection. We need to start moving more German weapons into Poland and into Eastern Europe. So very quickly, this withdrawal of the INF treaty has led to a brand new discussion in Europe about the role of nuclear weapons, European defense. And it's really just focused a lot of people's minds on, okay, we want to divorce ourselves from the United States. This is the real world. How do we do that now?
Yeah, it really is remarkable in light of what Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written several times over the years. Probably his earliest article, at least very specifically on this topic, is called Russia Frightens Europe and Fulfills Bible Prophecy. And, you know, what we're seeing happen with Europe right now, just taking its own steps to say we need to militarize because of Russia's increasing aggression, their flagrant violations of this treaty, you know, and now they're pretty much unshackled from the treaty if they withdraw, that it just feels like that sort of analysis is being vindicated in a powerful way with these developments now. At this point, though, the suspension of the INF is not official. The U.S. has said that if the Russians stop violating the treaty within 6 months, then America will remain party to the treaty. Do you think there's any cause for optimism that Russia will, you know, kind of reverse course and that the INF could still survive?
I do think it's possible. I don't know whether I'd call it optimism, but there's a lot of people now in Europe, and especially Germany, saying, well, you know, we kind of hoped that this whole INF thing would go away. We didn't really do much. There's now that, you know, they've now suspended compliance. We're kind of on borrowed time. If we want to keep this treaty in place, we, Europe, need to step up. And we need to start negotiating with Russia much more directly ourselves. Mm. And that perhaps could be a path for this treaty continuing going forward. I mean, we've talked about the relationship that Germany already has with Russia. Maybe if they don't feel that Europe's in a position yet to develop its own short-range nuclear deterrence and this kind of thing, well, maybe they will push hard and negotiate with Russia on this. So that would be one possibility. I mean, it does seem like, given that Russia for quite a few years has invested a lot into these new weapon systems, it does seem unlikely that they would agree to destroy them all now. But maybe, and that option is causing Europe to step up in a more diplomatic way to try and it's causing European nations to unify even diplomatically, to say, well, we need to do more so that we can speak with one voice on the global stage, mm-hmm. rather than having a couple of dozen different countries with different opinions, so that we can carry our weight more, that we can be a more decisive influence. So even just that possibility of negotiating is causing Europe to step up as more of a foreign policy superpower and to try and just unify its diplomatic efforts on this front.
Yes, it really does seem like however this shakes out, it's just a very significant development for Europe's rise. Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for the listeners and just let them know where they could go to read more about it?
Yes, well, like you said a few minutes ago, this really is a dramatic story that backs up exactly what Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has been saying about Russia. This is one of the key themes that he's been saying to watch as Russia rises. You mentioned that Fear of Russia article. I brought a quote from the Crimea Crisis is Reshaping Europe article that he wrote back in 2014. But in that article, he wrote, "We have been prophesying for around 70 years that Eastern Europe would become a vital part of a new European superpower, a resurrected Holy Roman Empire. This prophecy is directly related to the Crimea crisis. The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way, in precise accordance with the description of that European empire." And you know, that was a fear in Ukraine of Russian ground forces and Russian aggression. Now you're seeing a real fear of Russia being able to threaten nuclear oblivion to Europe's capitals. That is a very real sense of fear. And so that's going to have if they can't come up with some diplomatic solution, that is going to have a very real effect on Europe. And Mr. Flurry's analysis there, it's based on several key Bible prophecies. It's based on this prophecy in Revelation 17 that you would have these 10 kings. Daniel 11 describes the same power as the king of the north, and it describes this king of the north even in conflict with Russia. History tells you that they're going to have a massive impact on each other. Bible prophecy, you can see that same kind of conflict brewing between the two of them. And you can, like I said, you can read a lot more about that in that article. The Crimean crisis is reshaping Europe.
And we'll be sure to have a link to that article in the show notes as well. Thanks very much for that, Richard. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump delivered the much-anticipated and actually very well-received State of the Union address on Tuesday night. And at one point, he told the members of Congress that the State of the Union is strong. But if you look at the ideologies of many of those congressmen and just consider what they are working to turn the U.S. into, it really casts some serious doubt on that assessment of President Trump's there. To tell us about this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, during the State of the Union address, the president had two main themes that really came through, which was secure borders and free markets. Large parts of the speech were dedicated to showing how we need to secure our southern border and ensure the freedom of America's economy. And he did actually quite a clever kind of like bait and switch to where the President Trump was talking about the crisis in Venezuela and the United States' recognition of a new interim president who's mm-hmm. committed to opening more free markets in Venezuela. And got people clapping that America was standing up for freedom in Venezuela before turning the coin and saying, here in the United States, we are alarmed by new calls to adopt socialism in our country. America was founded on liberty and independence, not government coercion, domination, and control. We are born free and we will stay free. Tonight, we renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country. which that paragraph, I mean, a lot of high sounding language. It fits well within a State of the Union address any president could have given, really. I'm pretty sure it sounds like similar comments that former presidents Harry Truman or John F. Kennedy would have said. Mm-hmm. But the interesting point, getting back to what you're saying about the State of the Union being strong, is both Harry Truman and John F. Kennedy were Democrats, and they could have said that statement, and it would have been a kind of like a duh moment to say that we're renewing our resolve that America will never be a socialist country.
Yeah.
But now with President Trump saying it, this statement is actually in the aftermath become quite controversial. Many major news outlets disputing his statement that America will never be a socialist country. And then they found out that probably at least about one in four people in the room when he said that disagreed with him.
Well, so quite a stark contrast from what Truman or Kennedy, you know, the audience that would have been hearing their speeches.
Right. The Democratic Party under Truman or Kennedy and the Republican Party in that time were both against the idea of America being a socialist country. Where now with you've got the Congressional Progressive Caucus has 100 members, all Democrats except for Senator Bernie Sanders, who's an independent who votes with the Democrats. Mm-hmm. But you've got these 100 people who are dedicated to the idea of democratic socialism, that America should be a socialist country. And even beyond those 100 people, there's a few more that think that socialism has a lot of good points. And so Epoch Times had brought out kind of an analysis of the Congress saying that probably at least one in four people, 25% of Congress, believes America should be a socialist country. And so now you're President Trump's talking about the State of the Union being strong, but what he isn't mentioning is that we're going into another presidential election in 2 years where the fault lines are being drawn, where this is going to be a very overt the Constitution versus socialism.
Yeah, I thought that was remarkable. They cut quickly to Bernie Sanders after President Trump, you know, said the U.S. will never be socialist, and the expression on his face was, you know, if looks could kill, it was
right. It's hard to read. I've heard several people tell me that. It's like, oh, Bernie Sanders had a grumpy look on his face. I'm like, how can you tell?
Do you think that we can expect the socialist elements in Congress and, you know, in other parts of the American leadership to gain more power and to steer the U.S. more into a socialist direction?
Well, I mean, elections are always hard to call, but at this juncture, it definitely looks like with the new candidates announcing their intention to run, that the 2020 election is definitely going to be Donald Trump versus the socialist. And so those fault lines are going to intensify. So I think the socialist movement will gain strength. I'm not saying that they're going to succeed in transforming America into a socialist country. And as a matter of fact, the Bible indicates that they won't. And the show notes will put a reprint article from our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, entitled Communism in America Today, which traces the historical roots of this socialist movement in America, and quotes some Bible prophecies in Hosea 7 and Isaiah 1. The one in Hosea 7 talk about America being mixed with foreigners or even foreign ideologies, like communism and socialism are ideas that were imported to America from Russia and Germany. But then that verse in Isaiah 7 talking about like the whole head being sick and the whole heart being faint and the people revolting is just really a very graphic prophecy that Mr. Fleury explains. That it says, when we're talking about the whole head of the nation, the head of the nation is the government of the nation. It's like, mm-hmm. So the government is sick in its reasoning and faint in its heart, and that's causing people to revolt and just bringing great calamity on America. And so that's what the Bible's not indicating, that America's going to become a socialist country, but there is some strong indication that this sickness and reasoning and this faintness of heart is going to cause catastrophe as you have ideologies clash with ideologies. You can't, the Constitution and socialism are not compatible, and a house divided against itself can't stand. And that's what we were looking forward to in the next couple of years as you move into this election, as you've got two completely immiscible, incompatible ideologies that are going to clash, and neither one's going to win in the end. It's just going to be that the house divided against itself cannot stand, so then it will fall. And that reprint article just brings out that this is like divine correction, because the nation's turned away from God's law. Everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes, and that's what's causing this chaos and this gridlock and this infighting that you see in Washington today.
Yes. Yeah, we'll be sure to include a link to that very powerful article that really puts this in context in a way that nothing else could, I think. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. Well, ever since China tested its first nuclear weapon back in the 1960s, the country had a strict no first use policy. But now there are signs that China might be reversing this policy. To tell us about this, we'll go to Anthony Chibadidwe.
Analysts are warning that as China continues on in its maritime arms race with the United States, it might be pressured to abandon its no first use nuclear policy. Again, just to expound more on that no first use policy, as the term suggests, simply means that it's a pledge by a nuclear power not to use nuclear weapons in warfare unless first attacked by an enemy using nuclear weapons. And as you said, that policy has been in place in China since 1964. But yeah, things seem to be changing, or it seems like they are heading towards change. The South China Morning Post reported yesterday that nuclear competition is brewing between these two countries, the United States and China, as China makes gains in weapons development and Washington tries to limit Beijing's military buildup in the South China Sea. It also said that recent successful tests by China signaled that China is moving ahead with new class of strategic submarine vessels that could be equipped with nuclear ballistic missiles, and that would be more difficult to detect than conventional land-based nuclear weapons. The South China Morning Post also referenced a report from the Carnegie Tsinghua Center for Global Policy, which said that there was increasing mistrust between the United States and China, and that was raising the possibility that Beijing might rethink the no first use nuclear weapons policy. And it also referenced another report from the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, which said that Beijing was looking at expanding its nuclear delivery systems. And there are many officials in China that are supporting that, obviously, and commenting a lot about that. One retired Chinese naval official said that funding is not even a problem. He said that the Navy has so much money to burn. The commander said that China hoped to narrow its technology gap with the United States insofar as these nuclear armed subs are concerned, from 30 years to about 10 years by 2025. Of course, China right now lags behind the United States, but now we are seeing a lot of reports and a lot of evidence to prove that China is really working hard to try to narrow that gap. That same commander, he said that the nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarines and aircraft carriers were, quote, two most powerful and cutting-edge strategic weapons that China should pull out all stops to develop. So we're seeing a nuclear arms race between the United States and China. China is really, really trying to push as hard as it can to catch up to the United States. It might never catch up, but it's building more of those weapons, it's increasing its nuclear capabilities, and it's getting closer to just abandoning that
Yeah, no sounds like
policy.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, those are, it sounds like some really ambitious plans and some, you know, potentially destabilizing ambitions there. Could you talk a little bit about the significance of China's increasing military might in terms of Bible prophecy?
Well, as sobering as it's very sobering, but the reality is that nuclear weapons are going to be used, and the Bible does prophesy about that. We have a booklet that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury wrote on the subject. It's titled, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. And again, it's a very sobering subject, but it is reality. But the beautiful thing about this booklet is that it talks about what happens beyond that point of nuclear Armageddon, and that is God intervening and just ending this madness and just ushering in a world of peace, a world in which he is ruling very directly. And that's the great news coming out of this.
Well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. The stories that we're covering today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be up there soon if they're not yet, along with links to the literature that we've mentioned. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information on these important stories. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Pope's historic visit to the Middle East, American weaponry falling into enemy hands, Europe's counterterrorism efforts in Africa, and whether Mexican drug cartels operating in the U.S. should be labeled as foreign terrorist organizations. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
The civil war in Yemen is just about to reach its four-year anniversary of fighting, and new evidence from this week shows that the war is being fought partly with U.S. weaponry that's fallen into terrorist hands. For this, we'll go once again to Brent.
Yeah, we learned this from CNN this week, an exclusive report showing that some U.S. weaponry had fallen into the hands of the Houthis. The Houthis are the Iranian-backed proxy force basically operating out of the north and eastern parts of Yemen, and they are the ones that the Saudi-backed government is fighting against. The United States has supported Saudi Arabia and their coalition to prop up the legitimate government of Yemen that is currently out of the country. And to do so, the U.S. has supplied a lot of weaponry to Saudi Arabia and also the United Arab Emirates. And in order, at least according to CNN, in order for Saudi Arabia to gain the support of local militia on the ground that aren't the Houthis, they actually gave some of this weaponry to Al-Qaeda affiliated groups to buy their support in order for them to fight against the Houthis as well. This is something that the United States does not allow. The United States does not allow its weaponry to be passed on to third parties if it is sold to other nations. And so this was done without the United States' approval. And then when some of these forces that were on the Saudi Arabian side were overrun by the Houthis then gained the American weaponry and the American Humvees and such. And we actually have some footage of the Houthi leader riding in an American Humvee, American-made Humvee. So now they have the American weapons. And these American weapons are obviously far more sophisticated than the weapons that the Houthis normally have. And so it's giving them the opportunity not just to have greater firepower in this war, but also it allows them to have a look at American technology and to pass that along to Iran or whoever else the highest bidder, and so they can use that technology in their future weaponry as well.
So this technology is more sophisticated than what they normally have. You mentioned there is there a read on how much of it there is? Is it enough to, you know, turn the tides of this of this raging conflict?
Yeah, it's not. There isn't. The CNN report didn't mention how much had fallen into enemy hands. I don't even think it's probably a substantial amount of weaponry to be a game changer. I think there's obviously much more at play here. Obviously, the first point is United States can't keep a hold of its weapons. We've seen this happen time and time again. We saw this last year in Iraq when initially when the United States was there, they fully supplied the Iraqi military with a bunch of different arms and Humvees and tanks even. And then when the Iraqi military cut and run, the Islamic State ended up with a lot of that weaponry to fight against the United States. Also, we had the Iraqi government give some of that military to the Iranian-backed Shiite militias that fought alongside the Iraqi military against the Islamic State. And so the US didn't want that either. But then you had Iranian proxies in Iraq using American tanks, and they actually used those tanks against the Kurdish allies of the United States. So American designed and produced weapons were actually fighting against American allies. So this happens all the time, and you know there is a lot of policymakers in the United States right now thinking, then what are we even doing involved in these wars when our weaponry is used against our allies or against ourselves? And you know that is something that's worth considering. I think in the Yemen front, the fact that this was published by CNN, they have been against the Yemen war from the very beginning. United States involvement in the Yemen war. The Senate just passed a bill of some sort that wants the United States to withdraw its support from the Yemen war. So this report just comes at a time when the Yemen war is becoming increasingly looked at by the United States as being something that they don't want to be involved in. And so this could mean that the United States is going to withdraw its support again in this war against the Houthis there. Now, looking at this strategically, you could say, well, let's get out of there anyway. Why? What are we even doing there? Well, the United States is trying to support the Saudis against Iran, basically. Most of the conflicts in the Middle East right now are proxies with the Iranians versus proxies with the Saudis. And in this case, Iran really does want to use its proxy force to control the southern Red Sea. They've talked about that is their goal. The southern Red Sea is extremely important strategically because it is the gateway to the Red Sea and into the southern Mediterranean. And if you have Iranian forces there, or the proxy of the Iranian forces there, they can jeopardize all that trade through that passageway. And this is a goal that they've stated they have. It's also a goal that Bible prophecy says that Iran has. And they, as the Bible talks about, Iran wants to govern, or the king of the south, as the Bible talks about, wants to govern these nations along the Red Sea passageway so that it can control all the naval trade through this area, which I think it's about 10% of seaborne trade flows through the Red Sea, the Bab el-Mandab, which is the small 20-mile choke point at the bottom part of the Red Sea. And so Iran wants to control that, and the Bible says that they are going to be able to control that. And so that's why we're looking at this Yemen war as being significant in terms of biblical prophecy. And so if we have reports coming out that the United States weaponry is falling into the hands of the enemy, the United States might be even more willing to say, all right, we're done. But if this Saudi coalition loses the U.S. support that it currently provides in the Yemen war, that would be a great victory for Iran. So that's the significance of this.
Where would you direct listeners who'd like to know more about the biblically prophetic context of this and just, you know, Iran's desire to control the Red Sea in that context?
Well, I definitely think there's two articles that they could read. The first one is one that's about to be published on thetrumpet.com if Mr. Richard Palmer publishes it over the weekend or so. It's entitled American Weapons Fall into Houthi's Hands or something like that, and that details this specific event. If you want to understand more of the strategic importance and the prophetic importance of the Red Sea passageway, you can read Iran's Red Sea Strategy.
Thanks very much for that, Brent. Pope Francis has just made a visit to the birthplace of Islam there on the Arabian Peninsula, and this is significant for a few notable reasons. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go once again to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Pope Francis became the first pope in history to visit the Arabian Peninsula. Nearly 200,000 people came in the sports stadium to see him, to hear him speak on February 5th. With people coming from all kinds of different countries. And he's talked a lot about interfaith dialogue and this kind of thing. I think there was a photo of him kissing some big Egyptian imam. The Grand Imam of Al-Azhar University. I guess they found some friendly Muslim for him to go kiss. Hmm. He wasn't allowed in other, Saudi Arabia wouldn't have hosted him, but the United Arab Emirates did. I mean, it's one of those stories that on the one hand, you're a bit like, well, what exactly to make of this? How long is the Catholic Church going to stick with this very open to Islam posture, especially given everything that's happening in Europe, the way you've got European countries becoming more and more anti-Islamic and just, all of these, a lot of political leaders trying to draw attention to Catholic heritage and being separate from Islam. But having said all of that, I think this is an important step for European diplomacy, Vatican diplomacy, and it ties in very strongly to a particular Bible trend. Psalm chapter 83 is one of these key prophecies that we pretty much reference just about every week, where it talks about this European power allying itself with Middle Eastern nations. And one of the powers mentioned here in Psalm 83 is Ishmael, which in Bible prophecy, well, even in history, the Arabs quite openly trace their history back to Ishmael. So that includes Saudi Arabia. It includes the United Arab Emirates. They're part of this alliance that joins with Europe. So now you see the Pope going over there, making these visits. We've been saying for a long time that the Catholic Church is going to have more and more power in Europe. You would expect then the Catholic Church to play a role in this diplomacy with the Psalm 83 alliance and the forming of this alliance. And so it's probably an important step on the way to forming this alliance that you do have a pope visiting the Arabian Peninsula for the first time.
Yes, it's an interesting development there for sure. In the context of that Psalm 83 alliance that we're expecting to come together, Andrew wrote a powerful article about this for the website this week. Do you have any additional comments about it?
Yeah, it is an interesting shift in both Arab and Vatican strategy. For a long time, the Gulf Arab monarchies have been walking this tightrope between radical Islam and the West. The sheikhs and princes and kings of the Arabian Peninsula, on one hand, want very friendly terms with the West because they're the ones that buy their oil and keep them rich. But on the other hand, they rule over nations that have a strong undercurrent of radical Islamic sects that they want to appease and keep from causing trouble. And so especially like the House of Saud for a long time, they've reached out to the West, sold their oil to the West, got their money from the West, and then used some of that money to finance covertly organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda. The tactic agreement being that those Muslim organizations would go cause trouble in some other country than Arabia. They keep their people happy, they keep their money flowing, and they keep the radicals in Afghanistan or some other far-off place. But more recently, you've had a lot of those, like Muslim Brotherhood especially, starting to call for the overthrow of the Saudi monarchies, and the gigs off. They're cracking down on these radical Islamic sects and reaching out to the Europe, and not that they're pro-Catholic by any means, but by having like the United Arab Emirates, the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, bring the Pope in, that does kind of throw a bone to the Europe just to show that they're we're on the same team against these more radical elements in the Middle East. The Vatican as well, it's a little bit of a shift in strategy for them in that since the Crusades, there've been very simplistically Catholicism versus Islam. But now, especially you've got like the Oasis Institute. It's a Catholic institute. It's supposed to promote Muslim-Catholic dialogue, which is drawing a distinction between the radical Shiite Messiahism promoted by Iran, which basically says we need to create chaos so the 12th Imam will come back and bring utopia on Earth, and then the more reasonable approach in some of these Gulf monarchies of, well, we have our disagreements, but we also have our we also have our areas of common interest. And if we're both working against these radical Islamic elements, we've definitely got some strategic calculus where these nations in that Psalms 83 alliance Richard mentioned have some common goals with the Catholic Church. I think Cardinal Schönborn's another one who's even mentioned solving some of the Islamic problems they have in Europe by sending some of those Muslims back to Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and then have Europe help stabilize those home countries so that you can have nations for Muslims and nations for Catholics, and then those two nations cooperating together against crazy nations like Iran.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does look like a shift for both sides there. And we'll include a link to Andrew's article on this topic, which goes into depth on that those shifting strategies. We'll also include a link to Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's booklet, The King of the South, which takes a deep dive into the Psalm 83 Alliance and just explains that Bible prophecy. Thanks very much for that, Andrew and Richard. Another story here that really brings Europe and Islam together. Well, it began on February 3rd when French fighter jets launched airstrikes at an armed convoy that had traveled from southern Libya and had penetrated deep into the neighboring country of Chad. And really, that was just the latest European counterterrorism intervention in Africa. And it's all happening at a time when there are reports of the Islamic State making greater inroads into West Africa. So to tell us about this, we'll go once again to Anthony Chibadidwe.
Let's start with the French airstrikes in the North Central African nation of Chad. French and Chadian counterterrorism authorities had been tracking this armed convoy of about 50 pickup trucks for about 48 hours as it was making its way into Chad. And representatives of that convoy later said that their goal was to destabilize Chad and to topple its president. Well, Chadian authorities apparently launched some airstrikes at this convoy, but somehow failed to repel them. And so they turned to the French, and the French Air Force then scrambled its fighter jets and managed to destroy about half of the convoy. So this episode really underscored the counterterrorism partnership that's growing between Europe and this part of Africa. Well, why is this partnership important for Europe? Europe is only about 900 miles from Africa, and Europe is beginning to reassert itself as this leader in the war on terror in Africa, because that terrorism that could be exported from safe havens in Africa could reach Europe. So Europe is really, really concerned about that, because this can happen. Terrorists can establish these hotbeds. That's exactly what happened in Mali back in 2012. Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists took advantage of political instability in the country, and they took over a chunk of territory that was about as big as France or as big as Texas.
Wow.
And that alarmed Europe, and Europe just quickly led an intervention effort. France was leading that, and those efforts did manage to push back many of those terrorists. But the French have remained, because the threats in the region have remained. Right now, France's largest overseas military mission is actually in Chad, and we can expect it to become even more active in the weeks and months ahead. And as you said in the intro, especially with the Islamic State moving into that region, the Wall Street Journal had a report about this, saying that an Islamic State affiliate known as the Islamic State West Africa Province has already seized hundreds of square miles of territory in Chad, in Niger, and in Nigeria. It said that it's making a surprise. The title of their article was "Islamic State Makes Surprise Comeback in West Africa." And it said that it has overrun dozens of military bases, particularly in Nigeria, which borders Chad to the southwest. The Wall Street Journal article says that this group has sent drones to spy on Nigeria's army and it talked about all the many different bases that it attacked and seized advanced weapons from. And it quoted, it referenced an arms smuggler who said that, well, these groups, they really want to create a big domain. They want their own country. And again, this is exactly what Europe really fears the most. That's why they intervened in Mali back in 2012. And that's the sort of thing that it will do everything they can to prevent. Now, the reason why this is important is because Bible prophecy does talk about Europe surrounding some of these nations and attacking, particularly attacking radical Islamic elements in the region. In Daniel 11:40, it talks about Europe clashing with the King of the South, which is radical Islam led by Iran. And primarily this attack goes after Iran and its allies in the Middle East. But secondarily, it also sweeps in other enclaves of radical Islam in Africa. I mean, verses 41 through 43, it talks about Egypt, it talks about Libya. So what you're seeing happening right now is really a preparation of that clash that's prophesied in the Bible. And if more people want to learn about this, if people want to learn more about this, they can read The King of the South. That's a booklet that the Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote, and it discusses this prophecy in greater detail. And it tells us more about what we can expect to happen in the near future.
We'll be sure to also include a link to that one. Thanks very much for that, Anthony. Well, here in the United States, there's a consistently high demand for Mexican narcotics. And along with the drug trafficking, also comes a staggering amount of violence from the Mexican cartels. The cartels, you know, behead victims, they hold people for ransom and commit all kinds of other appalling crimes, but they are not considered foreign terrorist organizations. Now, though, as these problems are intensifying, that may be about to change. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Andrew.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier in the program, the two themes running through President Trump's State of the Union address were secure borders and free markets. And that's coming right on the heels of last Sunday. The government announced that they're going to send 3,700 more troops to the Mexican border to try to secure it. In the State of the Union address, the president talked about the need for a wall on the Mexican border. And now in the aftermath, we have a former official from the Drug Enforcement Agency really stressing something that's been discussed for some time about the need to actually label Mexican drug cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. As you mentioned, some of them have actually even brought in advisors from Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah to teach them on the best way to smuggle contraband across borders and the best way to spread terror by beheading their victims. If you're beheading someone's not the most efficient way to kill them. It's something you do because of the psychological impact it has on your enemies. It's definitely a tactic that brings an organization power through fear or terror. And the former head of the Drug Enforcement Agency, Derek Maltz, he had an interview on Fox News this week where he says the level of murders and disappearance in Mexico, along with terrorist activities like dumping heads on the roads, chopping people up, dumping humans in acid, combined with unprecedented levels of death in America from drugs, justifies this designation. Since the drug cartels pose an immediate threat to U.S. national security and are to blame for the importation of synthetic opioids, which helped bring about the greatest drug epidemic in U.S. history, we need great authorities to deal with them. And we'll see in the weeks and months ahead if that designation actually goes through as a foreign terrorist organization, but it is something that we've covered on this program many times before about Bible prophecies in the book of Hosea about blood touching blood and crimes becoming so common that there's just no break between them, and that is probably the greatest contributor to crime in the United States today is gang and cartel violence driven by the drug trade.
Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit us there to read more about the stories we're discussing and to subscribe to our print edition and also our news brief, which we send out several times each week. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, and we are coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Tell us what you think about the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to our panel today, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibatidwe, Brent Noctegal, and Richard Palmer.
Pleasure being here.
It's been an honor.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And we'll leave you today with the words of Michelangelo. If people only knew how hard I've worked to gain my mastery, it wouldn't seem so wonderful at all. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.